Malloy here. Time for another story and another trip through the Wind Door. Content warning. For those of you that listened to part one of this episode, you already know that the next topic is going to be referencing the synchronicities between behavior in this episode and how it reflects on the irresponsible behavior of some folks in regards to the ongoing issues of COVID-19. On the School of Movies Discord, we tend to keep discussion of these things quarantined, so to speak. I can't exactly do that, but what I will do is put a timestamp into the show notes. If you want to avoid this discussion, just fast forward to that timestamp. With that caveat out of the way, let's get into it. We've talked about race relations, now let's talk about the coronavirus. Not the coronavirus specifically, but the symbolism between what is going on in this chapter and what is going on in current events. As very likely most of you have heard about by now, or at least you could have heard about it if you are keeping up with American news and very likely UK news as well. I'm not saying there aren't people doing this stuff in other parts of the world. I'm just saying the biggest defenders of it are in these two locations. And since that's where both Toby and I come from, this is the stuff that we live with. One can draw a direct correlation between the fact that the Wendigo of New Century reproduced through infection in addition to killing, and the current pandemic that we are going through on a worldwide scale, but more specifically, how certain people in certain parts of the world are responding badly to it. For clarification of Toby's noises, that's him stifling a scream into his hands. Given that he's the one most prone to unintelligible sounds, I really should ask him to make a glossary someday.
I'm sorry, carry on.
Okay, I understand. To outline it very specifically, the way this part of the story is framed, Mary Sampson is leading a group of people that are refusing to do what the government says in order, ostensibly, to protect others. Once again, some clarification. There are multiple reasons that the RSA wants everyone under its jurisdiction that go beyond not just having more people fall victim to Wendigo, but obviously we'll get to those complexities in a second. In current events, there are ignorant and or bigoted people backed by ignorant and backward people. Yes, exactly. Or even just straight up capitalism, that are going around and protesting the restrictions that local and state and federal government put into place, specifically to avoid more casualties than we would otherwise face.
But, Greg, they really need a haircut.
Look, I need a haircut. I look horrible, even though I'm balding. If I let my hair get too long, even if I wash it, it becomes more and more unmanageable. But I'll tell you right now that I will either just live with it, or I will spend the extra money and get a hair shaver and just have one of my roommates help me give myself a buzz cut, which is all I would do if I had access to a barber, rather than put more lives in jeopardy.
Yeah. Because, you know, you have brain cells and a heart. And, yeah.
Hey, everybody! Politics!
No, we can't do that. We're a podcast.
Full disclosure, I did eventually, a month later, go to an actual barber to get a haircut. When I did, it was basically because A, my home state and home city did a better job with its ongoing restrictions, and it got to a point where I felt safe enough to do so. B, I felt like the local barbershop was using proper precautions itself, and C, it was a black-owned business. And at the time, I was trying to show my support for the BLM protests. I got it buzzed as short as I could so I could wait as long as possible before doing it again. Getting back to the topic, the point is that one can understand how parallels could be drawn between the response of Mary and her people and the response of real-life malcontent yahoos. Because it's not a small thing that the chapter frames Samson and her people leaving as being good people, even if they're not necessarily making the right decision for themselves. And the one person who is in charge of the remaining settlers being this complete opinionated, bigoted, white supremacist asshole that is really even just a toady as opposed to some of the more virulently evil people that we meet over the course of the world of New Century. The good guys are doing the thing that not necessarily great people are doing in the world right now, so that makes this situation very complicated. I am not a religious man, but Shakespeare had a point when he wrote the devil can cite scripture for his purpose. In this case, the word that bad faith actors always use as a rallying cry is freedom. That's the primary connective through line here, and nothing drives me more up the wall whenever anyone's desire for freedom incorporates directly or even indirectly harmful acts. I think it's very important to say here, or to remind people, that this was written a long time ago. This story was written pre-Trump, never mind
Coronavirus.
pre-coronavirus. Yeah. Something that Alex has been very vocal about is that there are story elements in parts of his early works that he would not have included if he'd known how later events throughout the last 5 years would have made those moments insensitive and problematic. More specifically, the both sides narrative that has been thoroughly abused to the point of irrelevance. Reasonable people can disagree, and potentially either come to some kind of consensus, or at least respect the other's opinion even if they don't agree. Currently, we live in a world that spits in reason's face, and completely untenable beliefs are trying to claim equality with facts, science, and empathy. And to be honest, that sort of thing has been going on for a while. It's just that now it's so completely off the reins that civil unrest, natural disasters, and pandemic are the result of this level of stubborn privilege and bigotry. So, there's that. And in addition, I want to make clear that the situation between current events and secret rooms is not the same because people protesting the quarantine restrictions aren't just risking their lives, but anybody else that they come into contact with. I gave this some serious thought when I was pondering this parallel. It's unlikely that these people becoming Wendigo will make anybody's lives more dangerous. Most of the population at this point is dead or turned, which is part of the reason why Arlington made this decision about preventing people from leaving the territory of the reunified states of America to begin with. The concern here is that he is just worried whether or not there is going to be enough of a human population to sustain itself at this point, much less have the resources and the person power to fight off the hordes of Wendigo. So it feels, when he says it in the handbook, and when the handbook is read to other people, that some might interpret that as losing access to their freedom, that they are being oppressed. But the circumstances in New Century have gotten dire, and the circumstances in the world have not yet gotten there. They are going to get worse, particularly as certain choices are made in certain parts of the world. And for everyone's mental health, I'm not going to get into the facts of how bad it has gotten since time of recording. Facts are available, but that is not the point of this podcast. But the people that are making the protests here are not taking that into consideration. They are operating from an emotional place. They are operating from a place of privilege, whereas Mary's people are responding to this, as you mentioned before, they're responding to this into a post-Civil War world where the Reconstruction barely took hold before things started falling apart. Mm-hmm. So one can make the case that even if their decision is wrong, even if their decision puts their lives and their children's lives at risk, you can understand it.
It's also, I think, the disparity between these protesters in reality who are protesting the restrictions that are being placed on them are invoking the right to freedom, but over, you know, the freedom to sort of go out and work or to have access to a lot of things, goods and services. Whereas I think Mary Sampson and her people invoking the right to freedom at the prospect of what the leader of the Reunified States said in this book implies that if we don't do what he says, we are going to get killed, is, I think, a much more actual sort of to the heart of what the American ideal of every person having a right to freedom and free speech. I think that Sampson and her people invoking it feels a lot more like closer to the heart of what the meaning of that is, rather than we want to be able to do these things and we think that's more valuable than other human lives.
Right. And one of the things that Mary actually brings up in her argument back to Abigail is not so much the idea of this is what Arlington thinks needs to be done now to bring everything back under control. She is worried about, if we give him this amount of power over our lives now, are we going to get our freedoms back once the crisis is over? That's not an insubstantial argument. I can't necessarily make a good case one way or the other, particularly since that's an argument that can be a good faith argument or a bad faith argument, depending on who's saying it. But, you know, it's not something you can just completely throw out of hand, I don't think. And long-term fans know that this conversation is going to get far more complex once we get to the novel Arlington and some of the further maneuvering and events of Washington, D.C. are revealed. But we'll talk about all that then. It's just that, as before, Mary's people are responding to from an emotional place after enormous upheaval in their lives. So, yeah, that's as it is, so to speak.
And they're also making this decision not sort of as a instinctual immediate reaction when situation is just deteriorating. These people have lived for 10 years in circumstances with Wendigos, so you get the impression that they have probably are not making this decision too much in a rush. They are actually making this decision based off years of survival instincts that have kept them alive so far. So it is something where, whether you agree with whether they should be listening to those impulses or actually entertaining the idea that they could be doing more than just surviving, I think that there is, you have to appreciate the fact that they have actually like survived this long, and you can see why their impulse is to keep following those instincts that have led them this far.
And when we get to the discussion of the Cartographer's Handbook, we will get into the fact that Thomas Arlington has taken that into consideration. But he also makes the argument that just because they have survived this long on their own, that while continuing to do so may serve them well, it will not serve the greater whole well. there's actually a really great piece that you put in the notes here. Would you read off your first bullet point responding to this particular event?
It does go to show how important it was to Alex to create a moral dilemma that has no easy, clear answer, because a similar action sounds so much more understandable when it's written and presented like this with its surrounding context. And then you look at reality, which makes writers just bang their head on the table when people often complain about characters in fiction not making sensible decisions, and oh, in reality, like, they would just do this and your story completely falls apart. But then you actually look at reality and see people making these bewildering decisions that make you think that if these real people were presented in an actual fiction, they would be criticized for being poorly written.
There it is. I can't necessarily put it better than that. Our daily lives over the days, weeks, months, and years ever since certain people came to power feels more and more just like bad fiction, and that's the reality we find ourselves in now. So
the last couple of seasons of the new millennium have really gone off the rails.
Yeah, and so therefore, Toby and I are podcasting on a piece of fiction that on some level we prefer to our reality. On some level.
Look, I've been having Wendigos roaring past the window for some time now. You know, they are more agreeable to some extent than some of the people we're talking about, but I'm not sure I'm quite at the point where I'll be okay with going outside. It's been quiet for a little while, but one did snarl a bit close to the window just now.
So, moving slightly on from there, hold on, I'm actually just reviewing the notes here, because there's a lot here. This is what I got myself into, and I knew I was getting myself into it. Do we have anything else that we want to say on the cycle of abuse that was brought up in the conversation between Abigail and Mary?
We have touched on this here and there in our discussion up to this point, and I'm not sure I can really articulate anything other than just commending Alex for how he shows abuse to be a cycle, in that he doesn't just exhibit abuse for the sole reason of just showing it, like, you know, a gritty season of modern television, like showing
a rape, just
let's get to the heart of it. It's that's far too common, and it's and far too often you see it and think, why is this here?
There are good ways and bad ways to address abuse or depict violence. Too often, what Toby is getting at is that these things are not given enough respect because they are used purely as motivation for protagonists, or are sensationalized in order to play on our feelings and give a sense of gritty reality to whatever we are watching. While this sort of thing can be a teaching moment to both protagonists and audiences, it is very easy to go too far and turn it into misery or torture porn, which does not add to the conversation in any way.
The reason why I think that when Alex actually includes these horrendous crimes and human actions in his books is that he questions where this kind of psychology, this action comes from, how it continues, and illustrates how it can work and how it can be prevented. And that's not to say that that what he touches on or what our interpretation of how he explores it is all that there is to say on abuse. It's something that requires a lot of discussion and reflection to properly understand. But I think that what we see here in this and other chapters we've seen up to this point, which touch on this subject, is an example of abuse being explored through different lenses, with the object always being to illuminate how we can be aware of what we can do to make sure we never practice it ourselves.
Yeah. Whenever trauma or abuse is brought up in a story, the thing that I would look at, the prism that I would shoot these thoughts through, is that if you're going to have this present, you not only have to handle it carefully, and ideally you want to handle it using the voice and the experience of whoever it is that's experiencing it. If you're having something involving slavery or race relations, then you want a black person or a Mexican person or an Asian person on hand to reiterate their lived experience. Or if it's something involving rape or domestic abuse, then you want a woman speaking about it and giving feedback on it. And yes, I do know that this happens from a context not just where men perpetrate violence on women. There are obviously many flavors of abuse. I focused on women's voices because it is a woman's story we are currently talking about. The person that voiced Mary Sampson is not a black woman, true, but that is a separate conversation, and one we will have, just not at the moment. If it's got something to do with LGBTQ bigotry, any of that, those are the voices that you want to raise up in order to, A, make sure that you're doing it well, that you're doing it sensitively, and B, they are going to be talking about things that you or I might not have no personal experience with because we're white men and basically at the top of the privilege triangle here. But on top of that, when you're bringing these things up in fiction, and this will come into play later on, then it's very important that you're not simply having these things as events, but that you are seeing the very real road to recovery and healing of that particular wound that is a part of the person's arc and not simply something that happens in order to provide motivation for others. This story that Mary tells, there is no resolution to it. It's something that is meant to be a learning experience for Abigail, so it can't really do the first. Mary, in this particular case, is object, not subject. But what Alex can and does do, first of all, these kinds of things get dealt with properly later on. But at the very least, it's not brought up to shock. It's not brought up to play upon our emotions just for the purposes of telling a story that is exciting or has consequences. It's not simply narratively important. It is personally important. And I feel like that at least comes across in the text and in the voice acting of it.
Completely. Traumatic experiences and experiences which I think should be widely recognized as things that create and can create trauma should not be a writer's tool to create a momentary buzz. They're not the equivalent of an action set piece or a CGI explosion.
Although in the case of action sequences, when we eventually get to Steamheart, we will talk about Alex's desire to create exciting moments that are also not callously disregarding of the taking of life.
They are concepts, themes that you explore carefully. And if you are going to explore them at all, you need to really question its importance. It will always be the prerogative of the individual reader whether they feel it has been explored with sufficient care. But for what it's worth, and I can't speak with much, if any, authority on this subject because, as we repeatedly say, we are in a very privileged position. I would say that this is considered. It is carefully considered, and that does go a long way.
Yeah, it is carefully considered by Alec, and it's carefully considered by us as well, because this is a communication to the listener now from us. So we are thinking very carefully about how we talk about these things, and we understand that we might get it wrong, but we are still doing our best. A final thought that occurred during the edit is that the story does something else right in regards to how it handles Mary's trauma. It is framed through her agency. The abuse was something that happened to her, but she got away from it. She managed to survive and thrive in spite of it. And her story is not only telling about the lessons she learned from that experience, but that she has the choice to not want to expose herself to further violence. She may be wrong in her assessment of Thomas Arlington, but the point is that she has a choice, and she exercises it. As a part of our discussion of this chapter, Toby and I never came down on either side of the conflict between Mary and Abigail, and part of that is because it involves information that we have that the new reader does not. But if nothing else, it is clear that we have sympathy for Mary and the choices she makes. We cannot blame her for fearing the loss of agency to a man that she has never met and a country she feels abandoned her. In writing this aside addressing Mary and her agency, it perhaps leads more insight into the very next question Toby and I tried to address. Perhaps it's the fault of me and my modern mindset, but at the time I needed help to understand why it was that Mary Sampson and her people were so willing to risk their lives, children included, finding out what Arlington and the RSA actually planned to do at the border. Because it's not as if that conflict would necessarily send a message to the rest of the U.S. In this day and age, you have instant media and cameras, and it's hard for something to happen without that information spreading around. But during this time of complete disconnection, if they went to the border and things went south, it would be so easy for the government to make that entire incident disappear. The only difference it would make is to themselves. The question that I was asking of you is it really just a live free or die mentality? Because Catherine Holloway had more reason to distrust the RSA than anyone due to her experience during the Civil War with her husband. But she agreed. So I was asking, what drives Mary to behave this way? And is it less about the RSA specifically and more about fear of losing agency to quote unquote Mayor Buck?
I think that would be an understandable concern for any individual. It is tricky to verify how much she and the individuals under her leadership believe in what she says is their reason, which is that they think it's worth the risk of checking if this government is that ruthless that they would kill them simply for trying to enter this territory. And considering the fact that we know there are children in their midst, that's quite a sacrifice to be willing to make. Mm-hmm. It could be that they believe that much in it, that the families don't want their children to live in a world which would have this stranglehold on their ability to live their lives. But I can't say, as I mentioned earlier, this is a sort of unresolved thread that you want to know more about these people, but because the agency they enact, they take themselves away before you can kind of continue the conversation, so you can't explore that. But I think it really is a matter of these people having, for one reason or another, depending on their personal life experiences, and for Mary, I think it's very understandable given what she's shared about her mother's experiences, her experiences, and even her recent living with Mayor Buck, being someone who continuously challenges her trying to keep her people alive, which should be such a basic fundamental right, and yet she's continuously challenged on it by an idiot. And I think she has to worry, like, how much that will be worsened when she's not answering to some local idiot, but to someone who actually has state authority and is actually a lot more ruthless.
The way that Toby put this, in hindsight, that could well be the end of the conversation there. We've already seen what someone more ruthless would do. We don't have to imagine it.
Because I imagine that she is exacerbated by Buck and has to contend with him every day, but sort of views him as relatively harmless. He is not going to enact physical harm on these people as much as his words are toxic to the worst degree. He is, like, just a local nuisance, but someone like Arlington and what they infer in his words, I think, does imply to them, we can deal with a buck. We don't know if we can deal with this. And what we've heard makes us concerned enough that we really do think our best bet is out there. And to answer your point about why Catherine would be recipient of the cartographers and their stated goal, you have to remember that when we saw Catherine talking to the children of Weirwood back in one of the early chapters, she does mention that the plan is to survive and endure until there is some sort of governmental effort from the military to take back the country and to eradicate the Wendigo threat. And that was in the very early days when it hadn't been weeks or months or even years. It was still the start of this outbreak. So you wonder, does she still hold to that plan? Is she waiting for it? And is the day that Annie and Butler come to her doorstep and explain what the government's plan is? Mm-hmm. I think that you sort of, like, you can infer whether she is still holding to that original plan and belief of hers that one day the government will take back action. But I think that she probably did hear Annie, and by sort of symbolically shaking her hand and trusting her, I think she believed that this was the best chance to make that reality that she envisioned way back when this first started come to pass. So she saw this as the best way to make the world safe again. But I don't think that Samson or the people under her leadership hear what Arlington has to say and think that the world will be safer if his plan comes to pass. I think that they will see it as worse, and whether that's a case of them not valuing the idea of a refounded society, I don't think that even comes into question for them. It's not really about can they even survive without the infrastructure of a civilization. I think for them, it really does come down to the person who holds a grip over you. And for them, that is more frightening than anything the Wendigo can do to them. To be honest, they probably have already seen what the Wendigo can do to them, and they feel prepared for that. They don't know what Arlington and their worst fears about him, if they come to pass, what he might do to them or represent. Again, we've talked about how unintentional parallels, the idea of, oh, better the enemy I know than the enemy I don't know, or like, oh,
yeah,
this can be, it is a sort of something I don't particularly hold to. But like I said earlier, context means a lot. I don't know if I would come to the same decision, but the point is I can understand why she comes to it.
Something that you said earlier does put into context for me something that I had not necessarily considered until just now, which is that Catherine Holloway has a measure of privilege that Mary Sampson doesn't necessarily feel that she can count on.
And I think I'm going to leave the conversation there. We did go on to mention a few other things, but it's a repetition of some of the points we covered in Episode 9. And the simple truth of the matter is, as stated, agency is more important to them than mere survival. And if your lived experience is agency being denied you time and again, then you will die defending it, for you and yours. It should go without saying that there is a difference between loss of agency and loss of privilege. Being free to live your life unmolested and being free to do whatever you want without sanction is very different. But considering the many things we have discussed and the current state of the world, apparently I have to say it anyway. Not that it matters, because those people don't listen to this podcast and wouldn't care anyway. But sometimes you have to rail about the insanity of it all.
So, yeah. As you may be aware, I'm planning on putting in a quote at the beginning of every description of every episode that we do of this. For this episode, I may just put that in as the quote. The noise that Toby just made.
You may as well put in, like, a sort of extended, like, completely based out version of Sideshow Bob getting hit in the face with a racket.
Oh, dear. Yeah. I guess we should probably talk about Mayor Buck a little, maybe. Not long.
Part of me wants to go back and remove every instance of calling him Mayor, and instead refer to him by his given name, Caleb. Because he sure isn't worthy of that title any more than certain other leaders are.
Yeah.
His name means, you know, a male deer who you typically associate with just butting heads with other people. I think it's self-explanatory that this guy is a bit of a nuisance.
Oh, God, that's great. I hadn't even thought about applying nameology to some of the discussion topics here. No, actually, I take that back. The fact that Mary Samson's name, that her surname invokes the hero from the Bible, I considered talking more about that. But then I would have to talk more about the importance of hair to the story of Samson. And going in and talking about a black woman's hair is a way to completely embarrass myself. So
yeah,
I think
we're bailing out now.
Okay, but let's talk about Mayor Buck. Something. Okay, we'll run over the top of it. At the very least, we should make clear that when Alex wrote Mayor Buck, and honestly, when he wrote the characters of any of the later antagonists or problematic people in the course of New Century, Buck is not supposed to be an analogy for the man we'll just refer to as 45 going forward, but it's hard not to draw certain parallels. I mean, on some levels, it's even worse. Because it's not just that our first introduction to him was him giving a racially coded insult to Mary Samson. It's that every time Buck speaks, he reveals that he's not just an asshole to black people. He is an equal opportunity bigot. He is the most odious little toad ever, and he's not even someone that's like an imposing figure like Dawson was all the way back in Let Them Go.
I removed some of the points I made here because it was definitely reiterating things that I covered in episode 9, but the more I talk about Caleb Buck, the more he sounds like 45. If there is anything different about him, the thing that makes us not fear him is that it doesn't feel like there is anyone that stands fully behind him. He doesn't have men, and it would have to be men, willing to intercede for him like Mary does. Unfortunately, as longtime readers know, such a man does exist in later books.
I asked you at the time to do a little bit of research into finding out, was Mayor Buck's opinions about anybody that was not a white American as opposed to a white person of some other social or ethnic background, was that common? And you came up with an interesting little link here. We'll include this on the show description.
There were actually two links provided, but apparently I went right on to discuss the one that had nothing to do with the context I had begun with. Fortunately, we didn't forget the subject entirely. You'll just have to wait till the end of this particular topic list to learn what Toby uncovered about Southern anti-British sentiment.
Well, in this case, it was specifically about the role of women in both Civil War and post-Civil War South. Would you mind reading some of the conclusions that you came up with?
Well, from what I can tell, the emphasis on women supporting their men is, as they went off to war, was an image that the South encouraged during the Civil War. So I suspect that in the decades following, Southern attitudes would continue to see the most appropriate role for a woman to be a passive one. Interestingly enough, however, one article I checked, which you're referring to, is from Jacqueline G. Campbell, the Associate Professor of American History at Francis Marion University. And she claims that there were a documented 400 instances of women who claimed to have disguised themselves to take up arms. And, you know, evidence to back up each of these claims would waver from case to case, but I think that they are numerous enough and significant enough that you can make claim that a good proportion of those would be verified. As Professor Campbell points out, which is a good point, even the false claims were still indicative of a growing challenge to conventional roles. There is a pushback happening at this time, and of course, long before, in other areas we're not even exploring or examining today. And I think that there would be a vested interest in people like Mayor Buck establishing a status quo that reaffirms their view on how the world ought to be, not how it actually is. To get back to your original question of how bigoted is he being by the standards of the time, I think that he is certainly representative of a not uncommon belief, but it doesn't mean that he was being unchallenged at the time. No matter what time period we're judging this guy by, from our modern sensibilities, which I think Alex would probably agree that New Century is very well researched, but it will always be indicative of a sort of modern sensibilities in a new world that he would hope would come to pass. So a lot of the characters, however they may act and however they may tie into attitudes of the time, we should challenge and judge them based on what we believe today. So when Mayor Buck is acting the way he is, we go, oh, you're a jackass.
Toby keeps using the word modern sensibilities, and he's not necessarily wrong in using that word. But I went back and did a little more digging based on what he wrote about anti-Irish sentiment in our show notes, and read that in the decade or so prior to the Civil War, there was a massive influx of Irish people fleeing the potato blight and landing on American shores. There was a clash of religions, certainly, as the Americans were primarily Protestant and the Irish were primarily Catholic, but on top of that, the sheer number of refugees caused a significant backlash against them. The thing is, by a modern standpoint, not much has actually changed. It's just that now, instead of Irish, we're talking about Mexicans, or people from Latin and South America, or Syrians, or any displaced peoples from a place of violence and strife. And because America is really good at specifically hating anyone that doesn't speak English or has darker skin, the bigotry continues. I don't necessarily have a good word for what it is to wholeheartedly embrace anyone regardless of race, ethnicity, religion, sexuality, or gender. That is just what I and many others like me believe is the way it should be. But more and more, not just in the US, but around the world, I worry that tribalism is just baked into humanity. Which is why I went on to say this next part.
I think one of the most important things that the modern fiction artist can do is to imagine the world the way they would like it to be rather than the way it is. Sometimes being honest about the world is important, but anybody that starts talking about realism in their fiction will often set my teeth on edge, because realism in fiction tends to be a dog whistle for excluding minorities on various levels.
A quick interjection. At the time of recording, there's been recent news of the latest installment in the Assassin's Creed video game series being based in Viking times, and it's following the practice that the previous installment, which Greg, you actually discussed in a recent episode about reminding you of a scene with Cassandra, the female protagonist of Assassin's Creed Odyssey, and as you mentioned, you can choose between male protagonist, female protagonist, and the same will be true for this new game, Assassin's Creed Valhalla.
Wow. This segment has not aged well. I doubt my listenership doesn't already know about this, but I am going to try and not veer off topic again and merely say that, based on what we know about Ubisoft thanks to recent events, it's apparently amazing that we got the female protagonist option in Odyssey. Going forward, not only do I not have any faith in Ubisoft's ability to actually tell stories that properly include women and diversity, I never really want to give them any money at all.
I'm not sure if the rise of certain opinions is the same as it was before, but there is, I've noticed from time to time, these people going, oh, how accurate is it that, like, there would actually be female warriors at the time, or when that Battlefield game depicting World War One or World War Two, I forget which, so apologies if I'm botching this, but people were up in arms about the front cover having a woman soldier on the front end, thinking, like, oh, this is pushing it, and you're thinking, okay, like, A, there probably are documented cases that you're wrong, and B, are you really of a mind that we can't show a woman being a soldier? Is that really what you're going to tell me right now? Really?
And,
oh, there's our other quote. We're just going to sound like zombies the more we discuss this sort of thing. The two of us going, oh no, they're Wendigos. No, we've just looked at our Twitter. Oh.
For the first time in a while, I think the show notes are going to be busy again, because there's another link I will want to put up people to review. The actual subject of this video by Ian Danskin has nothing to do with our topic on its surface, but one of its core themes is the narrative that sexist white supremacist men like to tell themselves, that it doesn't matter what reality is, and they buy into the paradigm of their hierarchical pyramid where they are at the top, and any evidence of anything else working differently than that, even if it's a part of history, is a threat to that. They are essentially wanting exactly the opposite of what I was championing earlier. Instead of fiction that gives us an egalitarian and accepting world, they cling to a fiction that lionizes their beliefs, because no matter how much culture has been on their side throughout history, what they believe is still a fiction. I just hope we manage to keep it that way.
I think it's important that you found this particular link, because a lot of the other racial stuff that comes up doesn't necessarily come quite as front and center as the fact that Buck is having to treat us specifically with two women soldiers of the RSA, and they deliberately call him out on the fact that, is this going to be a problem, and you're going to have to say it to our face now. He says it to their face, completely missing the cues that they were alluding to. But, you know, at least everyone now knows where they stand. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, as established in the chapter itself, they don't necessarily make a decision to meddle further, because their attempts at meddling already have not turned out with the best of circumstances. But given who's in charge, and given the fact that the RSA is so unequivocal about recording everything, including personal opinions, and that information being passed on to peoples of authority, it's very likely at this point that Mayor Buck is very shortly going to find himself just Buck.
One hopes. And yeah. Whatever concerns readers or characters within New Century might have about Arlington and his authoritarian attitudes, or the potential for him to go in a dark direction with that, you can say, well, at least he does not suffer fools like Buck.
Just from a curiosity standpoint, and because I like the work that you did in finding this out, I am going to bring up the final point that you included in your research for this episode. In addition to what I can assume are long-standing tensions for some particularly patriotic sorts who have a preconceived notion that since America was founded in a war of independence from the British Empire, that anyone with a noticeably English accent ought to be treated with suspicion. I've read that during the Civil War, collaboration between British and the Confederacy was relatively tepid. British took a neutral stance during the war, but trade between the Confederacy and Britain apparently declined by 90%, while in comparison, large-scale trade between the U.S. and Britain continued and was much less affected. Despite it appearing as if British involvement didn't have a notable outcome on the war, it looks as if, at one point, the Confederacy were counting on military intervention by Britain and France to secure their independence, but this never came to be. So one can understand why Mayor Buck's particular proclivities might go as far as having a low opinion of James because he has a significant British accent.
I rather enjoyed hearing you read that out. I think I'll just put together like little research things, and you know what? You got this, Greg. Because
it sounds
a lot better coming from you.
don't please don't be putting it that way. This is a team effort here, and I want to make sure that each of us get the opportunity to speak equally on subjects. Don't put yourself down.
I won't have it. That sort of attitude is appropriate at this point of the conversation because it is antithetical to Buck and his, I think I mentioned elsewhere in the notes that the crazy thing about Buck is that he's inviting the RSA and all of their infrastructure that they'll bring with them in, because if some higher government power comes in and recognizes his authority, then that just cements his position there. So he wants that, but he's resistant to the variety of resources that outside influence will bring in. And one of those resources is more people, and the nature of having more people with more ideas, more talents, and more opinions and perspectives is that you're not going to be seeing just white people in a room. You're going to be seeing everyone in the room. So he wants the wider world to recognize him for who he is as he sees it, but he doesn't want the wider world to be in on his doorstep. It is just the most paradoxical thing that kind of eloquently shows what a ridiculous man he is.
I think I only have two words left to say on the subject. Fuck Buck.
Fuck Buck. It's always Buck, isn't it? You know, between this and Kill Bill, it's always... I apologize to any listeners called Buck who are... I'm sure if you've stumbled across this show, you're probably a very decent sort. Come on, and please defend the honor of Bucks, because this representation is not great, I imagine.
I feel that particular argument, because there aren't many people of note named Greg out there, but there is at least one person, an artist named Greg Land, that does work for comics that I am ashamed to share a first name with. So, this is not the place for that, so we'll move quickly along.
I'll just briefly mention I'm happy that the company I mostly share a name with is actually people's pet dogs.
Yeah. That and the very liberal, very outspoken character of Toby Ziegler from The West Wing, a character that I love.
I'll take that one.
Yeah. To take everything down a notch and talk about less emotional subjects, one of the last things that happens in this chapter is, as mentioned previously, Abigail revisiting the family home and trying to do her best to sew up the open wound by finding something that remains of her mother, a token to remember her by, because unlike her father, she has his Stetson to remember him by, but has nothing to remember her mother by, and therefore acquires the totem of her brush. But here, you know, somebody else, with the best of intentions, provides Abigail with her father's Confederate cap. And this is a very subdued moment that the story does not go into at all, except to show Abigail's reaction to it. But we already know her opinion of the war and her misgivings about her father participating in it. So I imagine that in her attempt to do what she can to tidy up this part of her life, that being given the Confederate cap threatened to throw all of that into disarray. But she manages to contain it and simply say thank you to the person that didn't realize what button they were pressing by giving that to her.
Mm-hmm. And it is a moment that has increased importance because of the added chapters of the first five chapters, because in chapter two, when we see Abigail in her family home having a conversation with her parents, and specifically the conversation we're alluding to where she expresses her misgivings about the war and her father playing a part in it, having this scene, which was in the original text, where she is back there in the same house and she gets that cap, it, you probably can't help but think that she would be remembering that moment. Mm-hmm. I mentioned earlier that Alex has this ability to create complex situations where there can be no clear right and wrong answer. And I think that this is similar, but in a more sort of contained to an individual person and their emotional response to an item, because it is tied up with so much symbology and like a part of her father's life that she doesn't understand and has this misgivings of. Nonetheless, it is a part of her father, and anything, it's even if it's the worst parts of it, it does have this bittersweetness to it, that for as much as she may be sort of containing a disappointed or like regretful emotional response to this item when she says thank you to the occupant of this home, I think that there is a part of her that is thankful to have at least some additional fragment of her father's soul and his life back in her possession.
There is a final thought that I have in regards to this, which is that it's not just what the cap represents, it's the timing of it. Abigail is now feeling very conflicted and frustrated and helpless over what she perceives as a failure on her part. And even though she carries the part of her father that she loves the most wherever she goes, the cappy cap from his soldier's uniform could be a specific reminder to her of that conversation after hitting Tommy Sweeney, of him trying to show her that the world is complex, and as an adult you have to live with that. Your mistakes, both from the best of intentions and the worst. And you have to live with the fact that some things are simply beyond your control.
Yeah, I keep forgetting. It's important that you keep reminding me that some of these details were not in your initial reading of the book, whereas I always had the additional content. So to the people that were reading this beforehand, they wouldn't necessarily get the full circumstances of what might be going through her head as she was holding her father's Confederate cap. And I feel like, again, the added chapters put together in a proper context altogether, rather than these moments being in Steamheart, make the whole here a whole lot stronger.
I will say this until I am blue in the face. Secret Rooms was a good book before. It is now a great book with these additional chapters.
Mm-hmm. I had something else that I wanted to mention there, but it has gone completely out of my head. And it feels like we have been talking for years at this point, much like it feels like years have passed in just the last few days whenever anything is going on in the world right now. So we'll leave it there, and next time we will pick back up by returning to the past and going back to our young protagonists during the early days of Weirwood and the experiences that would make them into the people they are today, covering chapters 14 through 17, which encapsulates part 3 of Secret Rooms.
Cartographer babies.
Oh, God. Yes, no, thank you. Needed humor, needed humor. Well done, sir.
It's been that kind of episode. We need that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for listening. We hope that we've been able to provide insight and food for thought and even some of the humor along the way. And we will see you next time on the next trip through the wind door. Bye.
Take care.
As usual with part 2 of an episode, after the outro music there will be some outtakes and bloopers. At the end, I included a moment where Toby and I do an impression of 45, which I removed from the original episode because, as always, I don't want to make light of this fascist buffoon. Also, to be honest, it's not that funny. But some of the surrounding commentary is worth saving, so it's there for your enjoyment if you want it. Once again, I found myself wondering at the right music to use as a capper, and as it turns out, downloading some other music onto my phone reminded me of a band that I haven't listened to in a while. Going all the way back to the early 90s, you may be more familiar with this band for the way two of their songs made their way into Tiny Toon's Adventures, or maybe we even saw the music video for their breakout hit Birdhouse in Your Soul. But this is a smaller known track off of that album those three songs came from. It's not my favorite song, but it's definitely apropos. From the alternative rock band They Might Be Giants, I give you Your Racist Friend.
This is where the party ends. I can't stand here listening to you and your racist friend. I know politics bore you, but I feel like a hypocrite talking to you and your racist friend. It was the loveliest party that I've ever attended. If anything was broken, I'm sure it some bullet head and the madness that he's saying. This is where the party ends. I just sit here wondering how you stand by your racist friend. I know politics bore you, but I feel like a hypocrite talking to you, you and your racist friend. This is where the party ends. I can't stand here listening to you and your racist friend. I know politics bore you, but I feel like a hypocrite talking to you and your racist friend.
Night has fallen and the Wendigos are quiet outside the window at the moment, but I'm very sorry that there were... I have no idea what was up. I don't think we've ever had as bad a situation as that, but...
Which means that they will come into potential conflict with the...
Yeah, yeah, I love it. Conflict. Combination contact and conflict. Making up new words by combining them. See what I just did there? That's an explanabrag. It centers around Major Kira Norris, who is a former freedom farter. Farter. Oh god, I'm 10 years old.
Istanbul!
Istanbul! Obviously, this is not quite correct. There is every indication that she was also a leader at Weirdwood. I have no explanation. I can't explain why I keep writing it that way. Because I'm just reading words off a page and...
Istanbul!
Istanbul!
Or he's trying to avoid the look like...
He wants to not encourage the stance of, oh, both sides.
Oh, dear. Oh, no, no, Trump, get out of my podcast.
No, banish. We're never doing that again. We're never doing that again.
It's good. Sorry. People on both sides. Now
no,
I'm
no, get him out. Get him out. There's Wendigos outside. You can join them.
Yeah.
Even now, staying clear of him. Fuck.
That's nobody's business but the Turks. Istanbul.